Welcome to Fireside Markets, your audio home for thoughtful and insightful discussions of financial markets, investment strategies, economics, retirement, and more. Fireside Markets is hosted by James Osborne, president of Basin Asset Management, a Colorado registered investment advisor.
Hello, this is James Osborne, and you're listening to Fireside Markets. Today's guest is Tadas Viskanta, mostly well known as the man behind AbnormalReturns.com and his book by the same name. Tadas, welcome to Fireside Markets.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
Appreciate you taking some time to join us. Anybody listening to this probably knows who you are better than they know who I am, which is a good thing by my standards. But spend a couple minutes giving us your background. Who are you? And how did you get into the investing world? And are you in the investing world professionally? Give us some backstory.
Well, I have been in the investing world for the better part of my adult life. It was funny, we were, before coming on today, I was thinking about some of that. And given we're recording this on a week in which the markets have been particularly volatile, down 1,000 points Monday and up that much and more the rest of the week. And I was thinking back to 1987 because obviously, you know, people were throwing around Black Monday references earlier this week in regards to China, in regards to the U.S. And I and you know, to show you how old I am, I remember the real Black Monday back in 1987. And I was in college at the time and was I had interest in the markets, and I had, you know, I probably had a few bucks in a Fidelity mutual fund, which was, you know, really kind of the only way that's the way people invested back in the 80s, back in the dark ages. And so I remember quite acutely Black Monday and, you know, reading about it in the newspapers because there wasn't the internet back then. So it's interesting, you know, I go back that far in terms of my active interest in the markets. And it's really kind of knock me out of the investment world. It just kind of got me more interested. And so I've really kind of been involved in some form or fashion with the markets ever since then. And so after I graduated undergrad, I was going to graduate school and I was working at a big bank in Chicago. And ever since then, I've been either in a trading role, an analyst role, or a portfolio management role. After I kind of left the corporate world, I was kind of on trading on my own. And eventually came to a point where I helped found a hedge fund. And after that ended, I kind of got more interested in writing and talking about the markets. And after having left the hedge fund, I had kind of a whole bunch of hedge fund knowledge in my head. And after in a prior role, I had done some kind of quasi-academic writing for co-authoring papers in, you know, the Financial Analyst Journal, Journal of Portfolio Management, stuff like that. So I was kind of, I had an interest in writing and I had all this hedge fund knowledge. And I wrote a book proposal on hedge funds, kind of hedge funds 101. You know, this is 10, 11 years ago before hedge funds were kind of a household word. And, you know, I pitched it and tried to get it published. And this was really kind of before self-publishing was really a thing.
Right.
And so kind of ran into a bunch of rejections and kind of gave that up. And then that was kind of at the same time when the financial investment blogosphere was just kind of gearing up. And I was like, well, you know, if this one thing isn't going to work out, maybe I can, you know, start putting some of my thoughts and ideas online. And that's kind of how Abnormal Returns got started. So out of what was disappointment has sprung something which has been, you know, around now for almost 10 years and has, you know, hopefully been, you know, an interesting source for people over time.
First of all, the 10 years piece is remarkable. And I know you told me that you don't want this to be congratulatory, but that's a really long time to be doing one thing. So it sounds like when you started Abnormal Returns, it wasn't what it is today. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, when I started it, I had a very different idea at the time. When I started it, I didn't put my name on it. It was anonymous, in part because I thought, oh, I'm just going to, you know, go out and get another job in asset management. And, you know, blogging wasn't really cool at the time. It was kind of, you know, it was
like, you're doing that.
Oh, it's like, yeah, exactly. So I was like, I want to get this stuff out there. But, you know, I don't want somebody to, you know, view that as kind of a negative. And so I didn't put my name on it for probably a year or two, or what I forget what, for probably a couple of years. And so, So that was kind of my thinking there. It was a little bit, it still wasn't a mainstream thing. And, you know, maybe that's one thing that's really changed over 10 years is that the blog as a form has really kind of, that's really how we communicate now not only in finance and investing, but in kind of the broader world as well. So,
well, and it can carry tremendous legitimacy and, you know, thrust people into the spotlight. I mean, the most recent example of this that I can think of is Ben Carlson, who I know you know.
Sure.
You know, who 2 years ago was nowhere. And, you know, his site, A Wealth of Common Sense, popped onto the radar. And, you know, then there was a book. And, you know, who knows? He's my age, so who knows where he'll end up professionally. But it's one of these things where the meritocracy of the financial web and the blogosphere is pretty awesome. And
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's you know, it's an imperfect meritocracy for sure.
Right.
And I've seen people burst onto the scene and then burn out real quickly or have other kind of professional obligations kind of pop up. But, you know, that is probably one of the most gratifying things that you know, I've experienced while I've been blogging is seeing somebody, like you said, a Ben Carlson, who I don't know how, frankly, I don't know how he does it. I don't know how he writes so well every day, five days a week, which is, I think, you know, I'm crossing my fingers, hoping he doesn't burn out at some point because, you know, I really enjoy his work and have been happy to see his success. And, you know, somebody like, somebody you and I both enjoy, Josh Brown, again, somebody who, again, like you said, was nowhere and really just through kind of, force of will, was able to create for himself, an online presence, which has really kind of, you know, transformed his professional life and really kind of has been kind of a shining example for other people who are, interested in getting into this racket. So,
yeah, I mean, I remember my first link from Abnormal Returns, and it's, I'll say for the record, it's still a big deal when that happens for me. And before this interview, in my head, you have always been and sort of are, you're like the godfather of the financial web. There's this like rite of passage that a blogger or, you know, someone with something to say has to go through. Do you feel this sort of gatekeeping responsibility?
No, in a word, no. I have never claimed that I'm a gatekeeper or anything else. I have always, my ethos has been, I link to stuff that I find interesting. I don't necessarily have to agree with it, but I have to find it interesting. And so I don't put something on there because I feel I need a link to this. I put it on there because I think it's interesting. And so, it's not the front page of the newspaper. It's stuff that I have found provides some value and some interest. It's not in that regards, it's also not a news site. It's funny because, you know, when you look at the traffic, a lot of people read it the next day. You know, they read the Monday Link Fest on Tuesday morning. Sure. Or, you know, half of the clicks are probably a day later. So if it was a news site, it would already be out of date. So I'm really looking for stuff that's going to hold up over certainly a few days and hopefully a few weeks. And, you know, in an ideal world, it's stuff that lasts for a long time. So, you know, so in that regard, I think being a gatekeeper, I think that's to me, it's the wrong way to look at it. And I know that I get people email me every day, you know, take a look at this, take a look at that. And, you know, almost 100% of the time I'll look at it. But again, you know, that's, you know, cause I feel that's sort of my obligation. And certainly, you know, there's a big world out there in terms of content, and I'm sure there's stuff that I'm missing. So I'm always happy to look at new stuff, but I don't feel like I'm under any obligation to, put something on there unless that it's something that really resonates with me. And so, and it's interesting because that, what, you know, I would be interested to see what stuff I find interesting that I didn't a couple of years ago or 5 years ago, and vice versa. So,
well, I want to come back to that when we talk about the evolution of ourselves as an investor, but talk me through briefly what your process is like. I mean, you're reading and capturing a very broad spread of information, and it's not just market information. It's not just investing information or economic information. You know, you last week or this week had a piece up about why informed people are afraid of GMOs, despite science that we probably shouldn't be. And that was one of the more interesting pieces I remember from that day's LinkFest. Where does this information come from? Is it coming to you inbound? Are you spending a lot of time reading? Do you have regular blogs that you think, I got to see if, you know, so-and-so said something worthwhile today? What's that like?
Well, it's all of the above. I'm going inbound, you know, outbound, inbound, Twitter, stock twits, RSS feed, email, and you know, and certain sites as well. So it's really kind of an amalgam of stuff. And, you know, it's and it definitely has evolved over time. When I started, it was an RSS feed and, you know, a bunch of sites. There wasn't Twitter. There wasn't stock twits. There wasn't a lot of those things. So it's definitely evolved over time. And, you know, so in that sense, I don't really care how it gets to me. I'm just hoping that it does, you know, that I see it and it gets to me. And hopefully if it's interesting, it registers and I'm able to kind of pass that along to people. So
do you think that there are certain qualities that strike you in something that you think is worth sharing? And to touch on what you said a minute ago, do you think that those qualities have shifted over time?
You know, that's a great question because, you know, I've been thinking about that a little bit. And, you know, when I started the blog, it was, you know, the subtitle was a forecast-free blog because at the time I really felt that it was really all about, it was kind of all about stock picks and chart patterns and stuff like that. And so those first few years, that's what which is fine. I don't think there's anything, you know, depending upon how you view the world, I don't think that's anything wrong with that. But to me, there's a, you know, it kind of touches on some important issues. If you're going out and issuing stock picks or stock recommendations or anything like that, I feel like you kind of have an obligation to the reader. And, you know, if you're going to get somebody in, you got to get somebody out for better or worse. And so to me, that's a really kind of a delicate sort of relationship. And that's one that I wasn't really, my bag. And so that's something that I've kind of avoided. And so I've really focused, you know, when I look at stuff, I'm focused on, you know, commentary and analysis, not necessarily on the Dow is going from here to here over this period. That's really just not that interesting, in part because chances are that they're going to be wrong. You know, everything we know about financial, you know, predictions in terms of markets and people's willingness to issue those predictions, that they're really just not very good at it. And so why spend a whole lot of time, you know, debating upon whose prediction is better? You know, there's more interesting stuff I think we can find. So that's certainly been the, you know, so in terms of the way I look at the world, that's kind of the stuff that I focus on. But, you know, as, you know, over 10 years, it's certainly shifted. You know, you've gone from the blogosphere, which was really, like I said, was pretty nascent and was really just individuals. And I think, you know, once the financial crisis hit, it kind of changed. Things kind of got a little bit more institutionalized. You know, the big online, you know, the big news providers, you know, suddenly had to become faster and more adept, and so they really were really forced to adopt kind of the mentality of the blogosphere. And I think we've kind of gone on from there. So you know, so it's really that form has become, you know, it's just kind of mainstream now.
Do you think that the type of content that you've seen on the financial web has changed at all in the last 10 years?
Oh, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure it has. I'm sure it has. But, you know, I think, like I said, it went from being a forum for amateurs to one that is more semi-professional. And, you know, I think that's good in certain respects, but I think something's also lost as well. So I mean, I think there's certainly a balance there, and you know, some of what used to be in the blogosphere is really just on Twitter and on Twitter now. You know, some of those thoughts, you know, some of that shorter form stuff has kind of gone on to into a different format, which is fine. You know, if you looked at my phone, Tweetbot or StockTwits app would be, you know, the one that I most use. So right. I don't think there's any problem with that, but it's just kind of, it's a different form now.
Yeah. Well, and I think the two almost require each other, especially as, I mean, blog comments have basically died. You know, I look at Josh has killed blog comments. Colin Roche has killed blog comments. Yeah, I've killed blog comments.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not a productive place to talk. And a lot of those conversations have moved to Twitter. I mean, I find myself regularly reading somebody's piece and then jumping on Twitter to say, hey, did you think about X, Y, and Z? Or this is great. Or, you know, I wildly disagree with you. And it seems, in my head, a better place for that conversation.
Yeah, no, I think they're synergistic, but I think the one area where I think that they're absolutely synergistic, and I don't even like using that word, but I think the one thing that I think is that we maybe miss out on, or I think that is crucial though, you know, especially when we're talking about investing, you know, we're talking about people's, you know, their lives and their money, and to make, you know, something can be lost in 140 characters. And so to make a really a fully reasoned argument or case or something, it frankly requires a blog post or something else where you have to go back and you have to, you know, take that discussion from Twitter and put it on in a more, you know, formal, longer form setting where you can really kind of hit all the nuances and the caveats and your assumptions. So I think in that regard, Twitter is absolutely crucial. And I think that, you know, it's hard for me to, you know, to imagine a world without it. But I think for, you know, those sorts of reasoned sort of arguments, they have to be a little bit longer form. And that's where kind of the blog comes in.
Sure. One of the things that you talked about in your book and that I've talked about is how do we consume information? How do we consume, especially, you know, information from the financial media? How do we make sure we're doing that wisely? Can you speak to that a little bit? And then I'm going to have some follow-up questions.
Sure, absolutely. I think there's a couple of different ways to think about it. And I know that, I know Josh Brown has written about it, and he's kind of, his point is that you really can't just block it all out. It's simply impossible. We're too connected. We're too, you know, there's just no way to block out all of the noise. So you really have to be, you know, you just have to be more of a conscious consumer of financial media. And I certainly get that point. And I would, you know, and I really don't have any substantive disagreement with that.
Yeah. But, and I'd add that we really like it. And yeah, so it's hard to not.
You know, it's hard, you know, part of the challenge is like disengaging, you know, what I try to do, and, you know, for better or worse, is try and put your, you know, try and take a couple of big steps back and try and view it from the viewpoint of, you know, your average investor who, frankly, probably isn't really, you know, they're not really interested in the market on a day-to-day, you know, it's not something that's fascinating to them. They have, their interests lie somewhere else in the, either their professional realm or their family or hobbies or whatever else. And the markets are kind of, in a certain respect, they're kind of a necessary evil. They have some savings, they have a 401k plan, and they're really just trying to put that money to work and hopefully have it grow a little bit, you know, to fund a college education or a house or, you know, retirement down the road. And so I'm trying to think about it in their terms, and in their terms, the less is more. And, you know, the challenge is a week like this one, when the financial markets bleed out onto the front page or onto the evening news or, you know, whatever form of, you know, or onto Facebook or whatever it is your preferred form of media consumption is. And I think that's kind of the challenge. I mean, I think for people who are in the industry or interested in markets, I think, you know, filtering it and trying to find a way to, to optimize your kind of consumption and, not part of it's a time constraint, but also, you know, really just kind of optimizing what you're seeing. The challenge is really, again, you know, and it's something that you probably deal with on a day-to-day basis with your clients is, you know, how do you, you know, what happens when you reach the, the client or the consumer who is really, who has given over their savings to an advisor or to a manager to manage that when the financial markets kind of intrude on there. And that's that kind of push point or that pain point is a challenge for sure.
It's interesting because in a week like this one where we've seen, 4% swings on a daily basis, I think a lot of us who produce content, and I'm going to put you in that category, feel compelled to say something.
Yes.
And I don't think at the micro level that that's a bad thing. I would guess that most clients of a financial professional, possibly mine included, would want to hear something. But it sort of creates this cacophony where everyone is saying something. And I wonder sometimes if we have this attitude that there should be less content except for my content.
that is a great point for sure. I think there is certainly that tension there. I mean, I think that, you and I and other people have built up an audience and, it's kind of like the elephant in the room. You know, there's an elephant in the room. We feel compelled to say something about that elephant.
Right.
And so, I think that's, there's absolutely a tension there for sure. But, it's a challenge because, look, Monday and Tuesday happen and crazy stuff is happening. And, it's hard to say, calm down. If you follow the plan, do what you're doing, whatever, nothing over the past 24 to 48 hours the world hasn't fundamentally changed in some way that you have to do something or you have to alter the plan that you put in place a year ago. So,
even that requires saying something. Do you know, saying that requires something.
I think there's absolutely a fundamental tension there, and it's somewhat paternal. It's somewhat paternalistic.
Absolutely.
Because again, we're talking about we collectively are watching this stuff on a daily basis and feel like we have a better sense of history of markets and a better sense for how markets kind of play out. And I think that instinct is a genuine one. We're trying to help people. We're trying to provide some background, a counterweight to what all is going on. So I think in large part the instinct is a good one. We're not saying we're not telling people to whip around their portfolio and start selling out of the money puts and crazy stuff like that. I agree. There's certainly a tension there, and I think people's instincts are good in terms of trying to put that stuff into perspective. I think it's funny because we've been talking. There's been a lot of stuff this week about the robo advisors and the rise. Robo advisors have been a topic for the last couple of years, and what's going to happen when markets hit a rough spot for the robo advisor. So I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens there and see it's been a crazy week and any sort of data that comes out of out of any of those providers.
Sure. And I mean, that's just so indicative of how we love this stuff. I mean, to the average person, finding out what the average behavior gap was at Wealthfront is probably not super interesting, but some of us are fascinated by that information. And so we then feel compelled to talk about that information. So if you're at Joe Investor and you want to be informed, how do you curate or selectively choose what to listen to? And how do you do that in a way that also avoids confirmation bias?
Oh, that's the $64,000 question. I mean, I think that's really a challenge, because like we said, when things get crazy, for better or worse, whether it's, biotech's going through the roof a couple of months ago, or the market tanking 1,000 points on Monday, that's when stuff kind of bleeds through into the general press. And that's when, people start paying attention. And that's the worst time to be paying attention, frankly. The better thing for people to be doing is, they should be reading books. They should be, learning about the history of the markets. They should be learning about, that sort of stuff, more so than trying to keep up on a day-to-day basis on the news. And so, I may be too close to the subject in a certain respect, because I'm doing it on a daily basis, and I'm hopefully providing what I think is interesting stuff to people on a daily basis. And so, I think, like anything else, it's almost like your Twitter feed. You have to look at your Twitter feed and prune it and build it out and cut it back every once in a while to try and kind of get it where you want it to be. And so I don't think there's a really great easy answer to that, other than, being really self-centered and say, just read Abnormal Returns and turn off everything else. So
I mean, you could do worse, I'm sure. Well, you must go through that process, obviously, on your own on a daily basis. Do you worry about your own confirmation bias when you're selecting information to share?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But I think, I think that's absolutely the case. I think you kind of fight that on a daily basis. And so, I think that's always an issue. And I think, but so you do have to expose yourself to, to stuff that's, uncomfortable or challenging, and try and take from it what you can. And so, it's easy to avoid the perma bears and the gold coin guys, but it's harder to, when it gets into that murky middle there where the ideas are a little bit more plausible, maybe, challenge your belief system. So yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. But I think, one thing that I try to do, and which I have tried to do over time, is, kind of keep one eye on the people who are doing kind of research. And so it's not just opinion, it's people who are publishing papers and research on, various quantitative topics. So it's easy to, it's easy to write that that the stock market's going to go up or down 1,000 points over the next week. That's easy, you and I could sit down and bang out that post pretty quickly, with some really scary charts or really cool charts and make it all sound really plausible. But people who are doing research and really, looking at, the low volatility effect, or looking at momentum strategies, or, fill in the blank. I mean, that's stuff where, you can't, it's hard to fake that stuff. And so they may not necessarily be correct in a certain sense, but at least that gives you some sort of counterweight to the daily grind of stuff.
Sure. And at least there's evidence that those people are thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully. Yeah.
We live in this amazing age of information. I mean, there's information everywhere. You're filtering through it to share with your readers. We're all sort of doing that at some extent. And like you said, pick up somebody new to follow on Twitter and cut off somebody else and try to make your way through this. Is all this making us better? Is it making us smarter? Are we getting anywhere?
That is a great question. It's not 100% clear, because, we still have that reptilian brain, and that's not going anywhere. And so when you see a screen full of red,
that, yeah, like the that, last week's wall of red on CNBC.
That primitive brain kind of kicks in, and you know, I know Phil Perlman has talked about this. You can talk about it, you can plan for it, you could do all, you know, you could do X, Y, and Z, but when it gets tough, you know, whether it's for the market or for an individual position, that reptilian brain is just kind of screaming at you. And right. So, all the strategy, all the quantitative techniques, all that stuff is really, you know, is interesting and I think in a certain respect valuable. But in the end, it kind of comes down to behavior. And can you really teach behavior in a blog post or a tweet? Maybe a little bit. I think you can give a little bit of perspective. I think you can kind of shade things. You can kind of, you know, be a little bit of a guidepost for people to kind of hang their hat on something. But can you change behavior? Maybe a little bit on the edges. Yes.
Yeah. At the margin, maybe.
At the margin. Yeah. So that's kind of what you're hoping for. You're not, you know, I think that, you know, I think that Jason Zweig wrote about that, you know, in a, I think he received a Loeb Award and kind of talked about his career and talked about, you know, writing weekly and monthly pieces for a long time about investing. And that was his kind of conclusion was, you know, am I helping, you know, I'm trying not to hurt. Am I helping maybe a little bit on the edges? You know, I think that's the most you can ask for.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how difficult we are as people. And, you know, I think all the time about, you know, the behavioral economics research and, you know, all this evidence that despite our knowledge of how flawed we are, we're unable to overcome those flaws. You know, you read Thinking Fast and Slow and you put it down and then you execute perfectly every example that's in the book.
Right.
You know?
You people are flawed out there, that general public, you people are flawed. Me, on the other hand, you know, not so much. I don't have these biases, you know.
Except for this overconfidence one. Right.
So I think that's, you know, that's always the challenge. I think that, you know, and Bob Seawright has written about this bias blindness. Right. You know, we see these issues in other people, we don't see them in ourselves. And maybe that's, I think, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm sure that's in part self-preservation, that we have to, you know, we have to hold on to some, you know, some ability that we think that we're unique in some form or fashion. But yeah, I think bias blindness is an issue. And certainly, and I think so, you know, so in a certain respect, smart investors and smart advisors are really building roadblocks, speed bumps, things that really, that explicitly take into account these biases, right, and make us, if not, we can't avoid the biases. They're innate in us. They're kind of hardwired, but at least make us slow down and think about and pause before we start taking actions, which, you know, on the margin are going to be detrimental or harmful.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell a story now that I tell all the time, and I apologize to anyone listening if I've told the story to you or on this podcast before, but when our oldest daughter was born, she was a terrible sleeper. She slept for 40 minutes at a time, whether it was nap time or at night, and she hated sleep. And we were new parents, and I don't know, new parents probably know as much as experienced parents, but they think that they should know more. But we just didn't know what was going on, and we talked to some friends about, you know, their experience with their oldest daughter, who was a couple of years older than ours. And they said that they had a rule that after 10 or 11 p.m., the only thing that they were allowed to say to each other was, "Thank you for being up with me." Because any conversation that tried to evolve beyond that ended up in a screaming match. And we found largely the same thing. And what we discovered was that trying to decide how to help our daughter get back to sleep at 1 a.m. while we're mostly asleep and she is screaming in your ear is not the best environment for good decision making. And so we discovered that what we really needed to do was have a plan before we went to bed. And then, I mean, I'm saying this out loud now and it sounds ridiculously simple, but it was, okay, if she wakes up before midnight, we're going to do X and then we're going to try Y and then Z. And if she wakes up between this hour and this hour, then we're going to do this, this, and this. And, you know, this is how we're going to make it through the night. And that was amazing because, number one, we stopped yelling at each other in the middle of the night while the baby was screaming, which was, you know, for our marriage, probably, you know, absolutely a good thing. And it alleviated the pressure of having to make a decision in that moment. And the reason I tell the story all the time is that I tell it to clients when we're talking about investment policy. And the whole purpose of something like an investment policy statement is to make decisions in advance and know that you're not going to be in a good position to make the decision when the wall of red appears or when the Dow's down 1,000 points on a Monday morning. You know, those are not good emotional environments for you to make investment decisions. And so what we're going to do is decide now what to do when those times come, because they will. And, you know, I think that this applies whether you're a, you know, kind of low-cost passive buy and hold guy like me, or if you're trend following, or if you're a, you know, value stock picker. You need your system to be smarter than you, basically.
I think that's absolutely right. That's a great story about not only raising a baby, but also sleep deprivation as well. So, you know, and I'm somewhat facetious, but that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, when you are stressed out and tired, that's absolutely the worst time to be making decisions. So like you said, that's and that plays out in the bigger picture as well. So I think that, yeah, we do our best thinking when we have, you know, a blank sheet of paper in front of us and we can really kind of map things out. And, you know, I've talked about checklists in the past and, you know, that's another way to kind of think, kind of systematically approach the world. And I think that's absolutely the case. And I think, but, you know, I think that's a great way to think about it. And I think that, you know, one of the big dangers is kind of doing it out of your back pocket. And that's when you are open to temptation. You're open to tips. You're open to your next door neighbor who just bought XYZ biotech and it doubled a week after he bought it. And now you're, you know, now that, you know, kind of kicks around in your head and like, you know, if he can do it, I can do it.
I'm sure I can do it.
It can't be that hard. You know, think what I could do with, you know, with that extra capital, you know, on and on. And you can, you know, you can hear that, you know, you can just in that last episode, you can kind of hear that voice in your head kind of going, okay, you know, here we go. And so that gets you off track. And so, you know, it's funny because we talk about the value. We've touched on robo advisors and we've talked about the value of an advisor. And like you said, the one thing that robo advisors have done is we've shown what the value of portfolio management is, you know, kind of standard, plain vanilla, indexed, you know, globally diversified portfolio. It's worth, you know, this many basis points. Right. And so we've told people, you know, we've kind of put a value on it now. Everybody knows how much that's worth. And if you go to Schwab, it's actually, you know, we're not going to charge you anything for that. And so we know what that sort of standard off the shelf portfolio management is worth. So what's that, you know, what's that next step? And I think that's the crux of the issue. That's the value of an advisor. That's the value of having a trusted confidant, whether it's paid or or your brother-in-law. That's, you know, that's kind of the, that's where, you know, kind of the, really where the rubber meets the road. None of us can, you know, most of us don't claim to know where the market's going or, you know, what asset class is going to be better than another one over the next quarter. But it's, you know, that behavioral stuff and really trying to, like we said, try to put a plan in place that you can follow when times get difficult. That's a real value add.
Yeah, and sometimes everybody needs a circuit breaker. And whether that's an advisor, or whether it's, you know, you don't have your E-Trade password, your brother-in-law does. And to get it, you have to call him and tell him what you're going to do. And he decides whether or not you get your E-Trade password that day. You know, but that, those sort of breaks, we need them. You know, really all of us. And I want to shift gears briefly. And can you tell us about your perception of your evolution as an investor?
You know, it's, you know, I think it's, in a certain respect, it's pretty typical. I mean, I think when I was younger, I thought, ironically, when I knew the least, I thought I knew the most. And so that's when I thought I could trade, I could pick stocks, I could do all, you know, do all of this stuff. I've kind of, I've done all that. You know, I've picked stocks, I've market timed, I traded futures, I've traded options. You know, I've kind of done all that stuff in one form or fashion. And, I in a certain respect, I never blew myself up. I was always, I had enough knowledge to know, you know, not to do that. But over time, I've recognized how, you know, as I've gotten older, that, you know, I know less and less than I think that I do. And so simplifying, paring down, spending less time trying to figure out the next big, the next big cancer drug is really not a good use of my time. And try, and so, so in that respect, that's one, that's maybe one of the benefits of blogging, is that I have really focused, tried to focus more on, you know, the things that I can control, things that I have some understanding about, things that are in a certain sense, slam dunks. And so, you know, picking where the market's going or picking a stock or things like that, that's stuff that I recognize now that I know, my edge is, if not zero, it's really, really small. And so it's not worth spending time on. And so, and I think, you know, that's an evolutionary process. And it's funny because I've been thinking about, you know, one of the things that you get as a blogger is, you know, you always get questions about, oh, what three or five books should I read to become a better investor? And, you know, it's funny because if I think about it, I have a really hard time doing that, in part because we all kind of come to this, we come to investing at different points with different perspectives. And I think saying, oh, you need to read these three books and, you know, that's going to make you a better investor, that book might not be the right book for you at this point in time. Right. And so, you know, what you're trying to accomplish or what you're trying to do, that might send you off in a completely, totally wrong direction. And so it's funny because, you know, we want these kind of easy answers, you know,
right.
You know, read Graham and Dodd and read, you know, this and, you know, you'll become a better investor. But that's not necessarily the case. I mean, I think, you know, what you said is correct. We're all kind of evolving, and our needs are what we want out of the markets and what we need out of them change over time. And so how you approach the markets and how you read about them and how you process information about them is different. And it's, you know, if we sat down for half an hour and you talked about, kind of where you are and where you want to be, then I might be able to really think about, you know, kind of go back in my brain and figure out what books might be right for you. But in general, saying that, I think it's a really difficult thing. And I think it's not a very satisfying answer, and it doesn't make for good copy, because, you know, we all kind of want short, pithy answers. But to say it depends and is, you know, it doesn't sound very good, but it's probably closer to the truth than anything else.
Yeah. Well, in a book, you never know where a book meets you or someone else, or, you know, you'll be in a position to love it or not. I was thinking about this. I just finished Shadow Divers, which was a recommendation from Patrick O'Shaughnessy, which is a book about this group of men and maybe one or two women, I think, who found a new shipwreck. And I'm not going to talk too much about this, but they're deep sea divers, and this is what they did. It's a phenomenal book.
It is. I have read it. Yes.
I think it's one of the best written books I've ever read in my life. But I was thinking about who can I tell about this book? This book, I mean, I loved it. And it struck me that I don't really know if I handed this book to someone, if their reaction to it would be the same as mine. And is it because of where I am personally and professionally and my outlook on life and all these things that, you know, that I really enjoyed this book, maybe more than someone else would. And it's a tricky thing to say, you know, here you should absolutely, you know, these books will change your life. Now, there are some things that I think people should know. You know, I do think that everyone on the planet should read Thinking Fast and Slow, and, you know, sort of some basic understandings of who you are and what the market has done historically and those types of things. But you're right in that we can't really predict where someone is in their, you know, personal evolution as a human being, as an investor, if you will. One of the things that I kind of harp about all the time is this need for consistency in an investment philosophy. You know, the easiest way to get yourself in trouble, maybe not the easiest way, but a pretty easy way to get yourself in trouble is to choose that this year you're going to be a low cost passive guy. And then, you know, maybe that's not working the way you want it to. So you're going to become a momentum guy. And then maybe that's not working. And so you're going to start picking value stocks. And maybe that's not working. And so you're going to start, I don't know, using oscillating Bollinger Bands, or I don't even know what that means. How do you balance the need for consistency with the reality that you're going to continue to hopefully learn more as an investor?
Again, that, you know, that's a great question. And I think it kind of touched on a couple of things that we've talked about. And one of the things that you get out of reading actual research as opposed to opinion is that you get a few guideposts, and I'm almost embarrassed to say it because it's so simple, but guess what? The funds that charge the least on average do the best,
right?
Whether they're passive or active or smart beta or whatever form of beta you want to talk about, the less you pay, the more on average you're going to keep. And so, but within that, like we said, that opens up a whole range, still opens up a range of possibilities. That could be a Vanguard fund that charges you a few basis points a year for exposure to the entire US stock market. Or, you know, on the upper end, that could be, you know, paying a little bit more for something with a little bit of a bias or a little bit of an active tilt that's, you know, recognizing that you're paying a little bit more for it, but not paying a whole lot, that still gives you a little bit of leeway to play. And I think in that respect, but keeping in mind that, you know, the headline is costs matter, the sub bullet points are, you know, you have some room to play with that. And I think, so, you know, like you said, that allows for some evolution, and that allows you to take in some information over time. But I think, you know, I think when we talked about roadblocks, you know, the other point I wanted to make is we talk about roadblocks. So changing stuff on the fly almost always is going to be a bad idea. But if you said, you know what, every September we're going to revisit our investment policy statement and see if we need to tweak it a little bit, see if we need to change some of the ranges on some of this, you know, I think that's a smart, you know, that's kind of a smart way to do it. We're going to do this every 6 months, every 12 months, every 18, 24 months, and just kind of sit down then and, you know, and let the market do what it's going to do in the meantime, because we recognize that making those decisions on the fly are usually going to be we're going to have a lot of recency bias, and we're going to focus on what's happened of late. But putting some sort of time horizon on that, I think is kind of a good way to force us to stick with the plan and revise it as, you know, in a more thoughtful and consistent fashion. But yeah, our everything changes. Our lives change. Our portfolios change. You know, somebody gets a bonus at work. They've suddenly got some extra cash, and they need to make a decision about that. You know, and so that's where that plan comes in. So I think that, you know, nothing's static. The markets aren't static. Our understanding of them aren't static. Our lives aren't static, you know, so on and so forth. So yeah, I think, you know, you know, everything's kind of constantly in flux, and dealing with that, you know, dealing with that tension, I think, is an important one. But like you said, there's a lot of ways. There's a few ways to do it right, and there's a lot of ways to do it wrong. So
yeah. Well, I don't want to keep you too long. On behalf of the literally, I'm sure, tens of thousands of us who read Abnormal Returns every day, or sometimes the next day, or even the day after that, speaking from personal experience, thank you for your efforts and curating the vastness of the internet for us. Todd, I also want to thank you for being part of Fireside Markets, and hope you'll come back sometime.
Well, I would love to come back. The time flew by, so I appreciate it. I appreciate the kind words. And like I said, we'll do it again.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Thanks.
For additional information, details regarding references made in today's episode, or to subscribe or comment on this podcast, visit us online at basinasset.com.